You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, April 28th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building, the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, distinguished professor of anthropology and geography, the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, David Harvey, author of his latest 17 Contradictions and the End of Capitalism, as well as others, will be on the program to tell us today about those contradictions in capitalism. Give us his take on this Thomas Piketty book, which is creating so much hubbubaloo, as it were. Also on the program today, the recovery that's not so much of a recovery. Nothing you don't know, but a new report makes it very clear the nature of the jobs that are coming back, to the extent that any are coming back in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. And congratulations, Georgia. Your new gun law already paying dividends, striking fear in the heart of six-year-olds out to supposedly enjoy a minor league baseball game they were to play in, but learning some real life lessons about attending what used to be a gun-free zone. More numbers on the Tea Party grift, reinforcing my theory that if you really want to understand Republican politics, you've really got to understand late-night infomercials. And Donald Sterling, a sterling example, just a complete a-hole who got his just desserts. Well, I don't think he's got his just desserts, but there was at least some sense that they were ordered and they may show up at the table. And speaking of just desserts, Michael Grimm, that huge, I don't know how else to put this, a-hole, who is a congressman from Staten Island, has surrendered to the FBI, for whom he once worked, faces a 20-count federal indictment surrounding apparently the sale of a health food company or restaurant.
Dude.
It was called Granny Says with a Z.
Well, there you go. That should be at
Dude,
least
you got
one
goji
of...
berries at that place, bro.
That's got to be
Scott Brown here.
At least one of the indictments, I hope, is spelling using the Z at the end of just because that's just so
the
annoying.
Poor taste, FBI.
I know a guy who worked with a bunch of FBI guys who used to say apparently that Grimm was just a horrible, horrible guy. It's coming as no surprise to anyone. And John Kerry freaks out some folks by basically saying what Israeli politicians have been saying for some time, that Israel, if it, well, let me phrase this properly. Israel is in danger of becoming an apartheid state if it does what it's been doing, I think, is
probably... If for an extended period of time.
Yes. Like a fine wine. It has to age into it. Folks, just a reminder, we are virtually completely supported by our members. If you can afford to become a member, please do so today at majority.fm. It is pennies a day. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor David Harvey. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Distinguished Professor of Anthropology and Geography at the Graduate Center of CUNY, author of many books, the latest, The 17 Contradictions and End of Capitalism, as well as two volumes on a companion to Marx, Rebel Cities, and others. David Harvey, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Professor, I want to start with some sort of more, I guess, more rudimentary things, and work out from there. But tell us what you mean by contradictions of capitalism.
It's the opposing forces that pull it in opposite directions, and the most obvious analogy of that would be that most of us. Have some tensions between having a decent personal life and our professional objectives. Usually we manage those tensions, but sometimes they heighten to the point where something has to give, and that's a major contradiction in most people's lives. But capital has similar kinds of contradictions like that, and there are quite a few of them, and therefore these contradictions give rise to a lot of instability in a capitalist society.
And they reveal themselves in those time of crises.
Yeah, no, I mean they become particularly obvious when crises break out. And you know, we sometimes think that crises are accidents, but I think when we look at the history of capitalism, you'd have to say that they're actually functional for reorganizing capitalism, dealing with the contradictions in one way or another.
So let's talk about what you call, you talk about three classes of contradiction. One is foundational. What is a foundational contradiction of capital?
Well, for example, there's a lot of incentives for employers to try to keep wages down. And to the degree they're successful, of course, they can look forward to gaining higher profits. And as we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years, the share of wages in national income has tended to go down in the United States and in many other countries. The trouble is that if you do that, of course, then the problem is who is going to buy your product? And at that point, there's a difficulty of finding a market out there, because you're reducing the wages systematically of working people. Most recently, we've tried to square that particular problem by introducing credit. So we end up with a society that's much more dependent now in terms of the market by using credit cards and having long-term credit. And as we've seen in 2008, at a certain point, that blows up because you can't sustain credit over and above what it is that people are earning for very long. And so there we get a crisis coming out of the fact that what's going on in terms of what individual capitalists do is not consistent with there being a robust consumer market.
And in some ways, I mean, you just described the past 80 years in this country.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the problem in the 1970s, in effect, was the other way around. The market was sort of okay. The problem was that workers were a bit too powerful and getting a bit too uppity, and so the share of wages in national income was fairly high, and so there was a systematic counterattack by what we call neoliberal policies, which included Reagan and Thatcher and Pinochet in Chile and all the rest of it, to try to reduce the power of working people, reduce the power of trade unions, reduce the power of left political parties, which allowed then capital to make higher profits from the gradual lowering of relative standards of the wage rate.
And so this was, I mean, so those 80 years we saw sort of the ebb and sway of sort of a demand side solution for this contradiction and a supply side solution.
Right.
And then
that even came out theoretically. I mean, the theory that economists favored in the 1950s and 1960s was demand side theory, which was associated with the name of Keynes. And then in the 1970s, we had a sort of a counter revolution within the field of economics, and demand side theory was thrown over for supply side theory, and that led to the favored figure of Milton Friedman.
And I mean, so, you know, from your perspective, when is the demand side theory, which, you know, I think, you know, to the extent that I, as someone on the left, I mean, tend to sympathize with, I mean, is that just simply unsustainable because of where it will necessarily lead in terms of a sort of a pushback by a supply side theory?
Well, there'll be a pushback, but also in itself it tends to be unstable, so that the solution, if you like, by just pursuing demand side solutions, by the time you get to the end of the 1960s, we start to find ourselves in difficulty. By the time you get into the 1970s, you get things like very high inflation rates, which are coming from sort of jacking up monetary demand without there being enough production to respond to that demand. So the Keynesian demand side, while it favors ordinary working people in a certain way, also is unstable within the history of capitalism, and I think we're beginning to see that in China right now, which has been operating on a demand side response to the crisis. And there are many people now who are kind of saying China is getting into real serious difficulties.
Will you also speak about the contradictions between the use and exchange value of a commodity? Will you explain that for us?
Yeah, well, you know, you think of something like a house, and what do we use a house for in a country like the United States? Well, we need it for shelter, and we need it for all sorts of, you know, family living, so we can define a set of use values that exist for a house, and all of us need those use values in order to live in a reasonable way. But then, of course, the house also has an exchange value, which means that in order to get a house, we have to lay out money to get it. And the more money we have, the better the house we can get. But the house itself is, of course, a form of value which stays in place. And so for many people, the house has been a form of saving. So people would have a long-term mortgage, and by the end of their life, they might end up owning a place, and then they can pass that on to their kids. But over the last 30 or 40 years, the house has also become a vehicle of speculation. So that the exchange value system is actually regulating our access to use values. And we are told, of course, that the best way to get the use values is to liberate the freedom of the market. But what we saw in 2008 and 2007 was that system really blew up. And as a result of really excessive speculative activity on the exchange value side, somewhere around 6 million people lost their use values in the house because through foreclosures.
So, I mean, let's also turn to the contradictions you speak about in terms of the tendency towards universal human alienation. I mean, I wanted to sort of bring us all up to around, you know, to so much of this sort of comes to a head, at least most recently in 08. And I want to talk about, I want to move into sort of wealth inequality, but I want to make sure that we touch on some of these other contradictions. So talk to us about the notion of universal human alienation.
Well, this tendency of capital is to develop technological trajectories that at a certain point devalue skill in work. Now, this is not the case for a small elite, but for the mass of the population, people get locked into pretty meaningless jobs and pretty frustrating jobs. And, you know, what the poll numbers suggest is that about 70% of the people in the United States either hate their jobs or are completely indifferent to the job they do, which means that you know, taking pride in your job and the like is harder and harder because the kinds of jobs that are available to people are fairly meaningless. And I have to say, since I work a lot with young people, students and so on, more and more of them look at the job market and say, you know, they're all meaningless jobs. And you know, rather than do those meaningless jobs, they tend to, you know, drop out and hope that they can found a rock band or something like that, which is, you know, they can take some identity from. So alienation is a very serious problem. And to the degree that, you know, there was a time when even a steel worker, and you could kind of say a steel worker is sort of exploited in certain ways by capital. But on the other hand, the steel workers that I remember talking to had a certain pride in the job they did. They were tough people and strong people, and they kind of would brag about how good they were as workers. But, you know, you don't hear people McDonald's or the people employed by Walmart kind of proudly talking about the nature of the job they do.
And in fact, you know, there was a new report, I think, that came out just days ago that suggested the quality of jobs. And I guess it was measured more in terms of wages. But the number of low-wage jobs that were lost, far more have come back. And the reverse for higher-wage jobs. And I imagine that you could probably also assume, I think, fairly, that the measure of pride, I guess, in those jobs too,
is very low. Yeah,
I mean, you also talk about the notion of accumulation of capital, so much so that it exceeds the ability to reinvest it in the economy. Explain that for us.
Yeah, well, you know, what capitalists do, I mean, this is a sort of crude sort of definition of it. They start the day with a certain amount of money, and they go into the market, and they get hold of labor power, and they get hold of, raw materials and machinery and all the rest of it, and they put it to work, and they make a commodity, and then they sell it at the end of the day, and they get more money at the end of the day than at the beginning of the day. So the system is based on a perpetual expansion, and it keeps on expanding and expanding. And this means that actually in the history of capitalism, it's been growing at a compound rate of growth of about 2.25% per year. Now, a compound rate of growth is a very peculiar thing. It goes very slowly at first, but then it accelerates and becomes very, very large and very quickly. And I think we're now at that point in the history of capitalism where there's nowhere else to go. I mean, China has been sort of almost colonized by capital now. Much of India and Southeast Asia has been colonized by capital. Of course, the ex-Soviet bloc has come out of the capitalist system. So capital is now kind of really totally global, and it's not much, it hasn't got much space to expand anymore, and yet it's trying to expand and it's like a very explosive force locked into a kind of a closed bottle, and pretty soon you see there's going to be some explosions around. And if you look at what's been happening to capital since the 1970s, there's been a lot of little explosions. Somewhere in the world, there's somewhere is going under. And, of course, in 2008, a lot of places suddenly went under. So I think we're going to likely to see more and more of that sort of explosive crises because capital can't expand beyond certain limits.
So, I mean, I guess the analogy is just almost if you take a snowball and roll it down a hill full of snow. I mean, in some ways, you're arguing that we're hitting the bottom of the hill in some ways.
Yeah, well, maybe not at the bottom of the hill, but we're about, I don't know, two-thirds of the way down when the snowball starts to really gather a lot of things. You know, there's a famous story about the guy who invented chess, and they asked for a grain of sand on the first one and then double it on the second one. And, of course, by the time you get to the 64th square, you're in astronomical numbers.
And what is those explosions? I mean, what do they look like? I mean, was 2008 a function of that? I mean, and if so, how?
Yeah, well, I think well, you know, there's many things that came together in 2008, but I think, for example, the problem in 2001 with the stock market crash and the end of the kind of dot-com economy then was you had all of this surplus money, and where was it going to go? Well, what Greenspan did was to keep the interest rate very, very low, and then people started to say, okay, we can deal with this problem by going into the housing market. So you get this huge asset bubble in the housing market in 2000 and so, for, you know, 7 or 8 years. And many of us were saying, you know, as early as 2003, 2004, this can't go on for very long. But it did. And then, of course, the result was when it did crash, it crashed big time. If it had crashed in 2003, it wouldn't have been so bad. But by the time you get to 2008, there's an enormous amount of excess money sloshing around in housing markets, which is unsustainable.
And so, I mean, do you have a sense of where that money goes now?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, of course, the credit markets froze in 2007, 2008. The Federal Reserve tries to unfreeze them and then kind of says it hopes the banks will lend, but the banks have not been lending very much. Many private firms now are very profitable, but they're not expanding because they don't see the market there, which goes back to, you know, the lack of demand in the system. So in a sense, a lot of excess funds are just being tied up in cash reserves. Held by banks, corporations, even individuals, again, this is not a very stable situation. Except that, to the degree the Federal Reserve has been pumping money into the market, you ask yourself, where has it gone? Well, it's mainly revived the stock market. That's been the big kind of beneficiary out of this. And of course, when the stock market revives, certain people in society are very happy,
right.
But a lot of people are left aside. So the rich who have invested in the stock market are doing extremely well and have recovered from the crisis very, very well, but the mass of the population has done very badly.
And And that sort of brings us to, I mean, I have been working my way through the Piketty book, and sort of because my children prevent me from reading for extended periods of time, also sort of slide off to reviews of the Piketty book and the way that the sort of people are interpreting it. And the let's talk about what, you know, how your perspective on what Piketty is arguing in some way. I mean, he is for the most part, I mean, very clearly saying that there is something inherent in capitalism, that is, that the rate of return, when it grows faster than the economy, I mean, you know, sort of, I guess, crudely speaking, we get this tremendous wealth inequality. And ultimately, he's sort of saying this is not a bug, but a feature of capitalism. Is that your sense of it? And just, I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, well, that's what he says. But first off, Piketty has not written a book about capital. For instance, you would have no idea from reading Piketty's book why 2007, 2008 happened. You'd have no idea of why crises get set up. You'd have no idea why we still have long-term unemployment increasing. So it's not a book about capital. What it's really a book about is the way in which capital can produce social inequality. And the basic thesis seems to me is very simple, which is that the more you leave capital to the sort of untrammeled power of free markets with no state interventions and the like, the more you approach a free market model of society, the greater the level of social inequality. But he buries that political angle in a kind of mechanical thing of the rate of return on capital versus growth. But you have to ask yourself why the rate of return on capital is so high. And my argument to that would be to say, well, that has to do with the balance of class forces in a society, the ability of corporations and businesses and the like to suppress wages and repress wages and to actually enhance their profitability that way. If there was a massive social movement that prevented them from repressing wages in that way, then you would not have the effect that Piketty describes. So it's, you know, actually I have a very simple way of looking at the same phenomena. What is really good about Piketty's book is that he produces a vast amount of statistical information, in effect, to show that the way Marx interpreted how capitalism worked in Volume 1 of Capital is exactly right. And he didn't want to say that, of course, because he's very fearful of being described as a Marxist. And, of course, we know that the right wing right now is dubbing him as a Marxist in disguise. And so it becomes a rather complicated sort of political argument over reputations and all the rest of it.
I mean, it's interesting because there was, you know, the I was just reading one brief a blog post by Felix Salmon this morning where he says that, you know, in some way that Piketty is very pessimistic in the sense that there is no way ultimately to, I mean, he offers, I guess, some solutions at the towards the end of the book that people are sort of, I guess, less impressed with. But there does seem to be ultimately a lack of addressing sort of the systemic, that we're left with no solution to this. That this is almost sort of, this is the way it is. To the extent that it wasn't this way was really a function of an anomaly that took place following the world wars.
Well, I think he's you know, it's pessimistic in the sense that he just simply says at the end that you need a global wealth tax in order to equilibrate the situation. And if you don't have a global wealth tax, you're condemned forever to actually produce greater and greater levels of inequality. And so you know, and you kind of go, well, actually, if you paid more attention to some of the other contradictions of capitalism, you wouldn't make that argument, because, like I said to you early on, the demand supply differential is very, very important here. And if all the purchasing power gets located in this affluent oligarchy, then capitalism is going to be in a lot of deep trouble, and there are going to have to be adjustments anyway. So we go back to a sort of a Keynesian type model, which again has its own difficulties, but which is what China has been doing, for example. I think he's set it up in such a way as to give only one possible answer, and I think there are actually a number of possible answers. But actually I have grave doubts about the nature of the central thesis about the rate of return on capital. That is something that depends very much on how you measure capital, and of course we know that capital is measured speculatively. And if there's a collapse of speculative gains on say housing or something like that, then the amount of capital in society is actually reduced remarkably through such crashes. And so the definition of capital is very sensitive to speculative movements and also to economic conditions.
Right, and I guess, I mean, at least to I mean, I want to talk about some of those other answers here. I mean, because from your perspective, even if we could get the global tax on wealth, that would not be enough because we would still have an unstable system.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously the levels of inequality we've now got are unsustainable in terms of having a balanced growth capitalist economy. And therefore they are a source of stress and a potential source of crisis formation. That would be my position. But that's not the only source of crises. And if you dealt with this one by redistributing wealth seriously, you would still have many of the other difficulties, like the relationship between supply and demand. You would still have the environmental difficulties. You would still have the difficulties of compounding growth and finding productive investments in a world already faced with tremendous surpluses of money, capital, looking for somewhere to go. So I don't think the redistributive angle that Piketty takes, even if it was followed through, it would not actually then stabilize capitalist society.
So, I mean, if so, in your version of his analysis, and had he included those other contradictions, where does that leave us? I mean, give us a sense of how of what that other solution that we don't really talk about in this conversation, or that is surrounded the all the talk of inequality. Let's talk a little bit about where we would start with that, with those other solutions.
Well, let me go back to one of the basic ones. I mean, would you rather live in a society which delivers adequate use values to the mass of the population, or do you want to live in a society which distributes use values unevenly and unequally, depending upon economic power, and depending also on the capacity of individuals to extract vast fortunes from that exchange value system? In other words, I would like to see us move more towards making sure that housing is a human right, and that everybody is provided with a decent house and a decent living environment, and the exchange value system, insofar as it can help do that, that's fine. But we've got to stop speculative activity in housing markets. We've got to actually stop the extraction of vast wealth on the, you know, by all of the mortgage financiers, the lawyers, the real estate lobbies, and all the rest of it. They're the ones who are benefiting from this exchange value system, and in many instances not producing affordable housing. For example, if you just take New York City, about 50% of the population of New York City is trying to live on less than $30,000 a year. If you take the idea that only, you know, you can only spend a certain proportion of your money on housing, then 50% of the population of New York should be housed for less than $1,300 or $1,500 a month. Where can you find accommodation $1,500 a month in New York City? You know, this is the kind of dilemma that we're in. In other words, the exchange value system is excluding half of the population from access to adequate housing. So, and I would make the same thing about education. Education should not be mediated by the exchange value system. It should be a human right, and it should be equally available to everybody. I think the same would be true of healthcare. What we have in this country is an increasing commodification, increasing monetization of the provision of all of these things. And does that benefit people or does that benefit capital? The answer is it benefits capital, and it benefits some people who become extremely rich by it. And then whether we get any decent housing, decent health care, or decent education, you know, really is a byproduct of what they do. So I would argue to people, let's work on trying to make sure that housing, healthcare, and education, as a beginning point, are human rights, and that it's the use value that needs to be provided to people, independent of all these exchange value considerations.
Do you see any? I mean, is there hope there that we are headed in that direction? I mean, there's certainly. I mean, I think, you know, Occupy on some level sort of introduced maybe those concepts anew
right.
In this country. In some ways that has continued to resonate, and others not as much. But give me your sense as to how we sort of get there. I mean, because the I don't know if it's the irony, and maybe it is actually, again, a feature, not a bug of this crisis, but those who there are the capital is doing quite well, you know, 5 years, 6 years
out.
Capital
has come out of this crisis extremely well. And the billionaires club has come out, you know, it came out of the crisis 2009 and made more money in 2008 than it's ever made before. So some people have done extremely well out of the crisis. And again, you know, you look at it and you kind of say, this is not a common sense world. I mean, the thing that strikes me was when I talk to people around saying, would you rather live in a place that provides adequate use values or sets up an exchange value system that makes the rich very rich, then everybody says, well, we'd rather live in a society that provided adequate use values to everybody. And it's common sense. It's not hard. Now, bit by bit, what's happened particularly over the last 30 or 40 years is the exchange value side of things has got stronger and stronger and stronger. We're now increasingly dominated and to some degree victimized by a financial system that is highly predatory and parasitic. And to the degree that we're dominated by all of that, then I think we should have people should really start to say, we don't want to be dominated by that anymore. We want to create a society that actually delivers the goods in terms of a decent living standard to everybody and a decent living environment.
I mean, when you talk about exchange value, I mean, is saying, you know, is describing our economy as becoming highly financialized synonymous in that way?
Yeah, no, it certainly has. I mean, in many countries of the world, for instance, education. My education was totally free in Britain back in the 1950s and 1960s. And it's just recently that governments there have started to introduce tuition fees and all the rest of it. I teach at an institution, City University of New York, that was tuition-free up until the 1970s. And then in the crisis of the 1970s, it was forced to start charging tuition. I think that higher education and access to higher education should be a free good. As it is, what we have now is debt-encumbered students, you know, over $1 trillion of debt assembled amongst students who have to go deeply into debt in order to get their education. This seems to me scandalous. I mean, we shouldn't be going in that direction. The amount of student debt, say 20 or 30 years ago, was relatively small. Now it's become enormous. And this is a dead weight on a whole generation of the population. And it's it seems to me this is not a sensible way to go. And we should actually turn things around in the opposite direction and start to try to move towards a tuition-free higher education system, and certainly have tuition-free pre-university education.
And so, I mean, how does this happen? And we have, I guess it was a week or two ago, we saw another report by Martin Gillens, which was based on other work that he has done, which basically says that we are largely, and by we meaning those of us who are not billionaires, largely powerless in terms of the policy outcomes of our government, in when we are at odds with the policy preferences of the very wealthy. I mean, what has to happen next?
Well, I think again, the only thing that can really do something about this is a popular movement which turns the story around. I mean, of course, one of the big problems there is that from the 1970s onwards, the Supreme Court has kept on making decisions about, campaign finance is a question of freedom of speech, and that what we're giving the freedom of speech to is those who have spending dollars. So it's not freedom of speech, it's freedom to spend money on elections, and now we've gone to the ultimate extreme of that. So this is in my view, I would call this kind of legalized corruption of the political system. And how do we do something about that? Well, if enough people get outraged enough, and we move from what I call the sort of passive sense of alienation, where most people are actually alienated from the political process, and into an active, angry kind of mode of alienation where people actually get out on the street and say, we need to change this system. We need to change it big time. We need to go back to the democratic roots of what this country is all about. We need to go back to the egalitarian roots of what this country is all about and construct something which is radically different from what we have right now. Now, will that happen? I have no idea. But until people do that, then indeed Piketty is right to say, well, we're just going to have increasing inequality, and the rich are going to get richer, and the rest of us are going to be sort of basically becoming disposable populations.
Well, briefly, I mean, and I appreciate your hanging with me, but this week I was solicited by a professor who is a libertarian professor from Loyola, because I enjoy, I guess, debating of sorts with libertarians. And and he's coming on. I mean, talk to me about the egalitarian roots of this country. I mean, because ultimately a libertarian is going to say to me about the prominence of private property, and it all sort of emanates from there, I think. What do you say when you hear, how do you address libertarians? In other words, help me out a little bit.
There are some aspects of what the libertarians talk about which I'm very sympathetic to, and it sounds to me like you are too.
Yes.
And the problem is that this association of individual freedom with private property. You know, and freedom to accumulate. And what does freedom mean? Does it mean freedom to exploit other people? Does it mean freedom to degrade the environment? Does it mean, you know, are those the kinds of freedoms we're talking about? Well, I think we have to kind of recognize that there are some things which are very positive in terms of freedoms of, and some things where some freedoms are actually counterproductive in terms of their social consequences. And the amassing of private wealth and privilege on the part of individuals is, I think, one of those aspects which becomes counterproductive. So when libertarians kind of say, well, we shouldn't do anything about the fact that, say, the leading hedge fund in New York each earned individually $3 billion each in a given year, that we shouldn't interfere with that. And you kind of go, well, that's not the kind of freedom that makes sense to me. To begin with, who produced all of that value which they're assembling, and how are they assembling it? Well, they're doing it through, you know, all kinds of manipulations of financial markets and betting about things going crash and the like. So the libertarian position seems to me to have some problems because it's so associated with this idea of private property. And that therefore the freedom that they mostly seem to prize, particularly in economic theory, is the freedom of individuals to actually loot the public interest and to loot the public wealth and social wealth. Instead of kind of saying, well, to the degree that we've all contributed, or hope most of us have been contributing to the production of social wealth, we should all, I think, in an unalienated society, have some return for our contributions.
It seems to me they don't even believe that there should be a public wealth.
No. Well, they don't think it should be, but it is. I mean, how are things produced? We actually rely on millions of people around the world to put breakfast on our table. Libertarians would starve if, all of those people were not actually working for them. So it's a social process every day that puts breakfast on people's table. And that involves, sugarcane cutters in Dominican Republic. It involves, the coffee producers in Kenya. And we are all highly interdependent, dependent upon each other. And then the question is, who is producing social value that we are daily consuming in our breakfast? I mean, if libertarians took it seriously and said, well, we should all be independent, then they should actually go out there and raise the bacon and the coffee and the sugar themselves. But they don't do that. This all comes from other people's social labor. But then what we find is the sugarcane cutter in Dominican Republic earns $2 a day. And, the sugar that comes on the table to a hedge fund manager who earns $3 billion a year. This is where the individual versus the social, needs to be probed much more deeply.
Yes, I agree, and I've had similar conversations with them. They still feel like that sugarcane cutter, he has a right to sell his labor. He's done it for $2 a day, and that's just the way.
Yeah.
Bully for him. Too bad he wasn't, born the son of a hedge funder or what.
Right, exactly.
And that's generally where we end the conversation, and so I think there's also a good a good place for us to end ours. Professor David Harvey, the book is 17 Contradictions and the End of Capitalism. We'll put a link to it and your site on our at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I genuinely appreciate it.
All right, thanks very much. I appreciate it too.
Bye-bye. All right, bye. Folks. Well, there you have it. I mean, it's nice to know that a...
So you got tips from a master.
I did.
I mean...
But I have to say...
It's same thing.
Same thing. I mean, that's...
I told you that. I said, you can go to the peak of the summit. It's like you just trekked up the Himalayas and
well,
you
what's
met...
amazing is that I imagine that Professor Harvey is not having these debates with YouTube libertarians. And, you know, and I imagine he is, maybe I'm wrong.
He probably has better things to do.
Well,
he's known for that. He actually has an open place at the CUNY student lounge
and random people from YouTube. I don't want to project on him, but, on Wednesday on this program, a professor, Walter Block, sent me an email some time ago before the vacation. Apparently somebody had sent him, said Sam Cedar debates libertarians. He is, I think, a professor emeritus at, he is the Joseph A. Butt College of Business from Loyola University, the Harold Worth Eminent Scholar, Endowed Chair of Professor of Economics. And he said, I understand you'd like to debate libertarians. Well, I'd love to come on your show. And so I said, yes. And I imagine these are the types of folks that Professor Harvey has argued with. And I sit here, I project that he's going to come on with a whole series of talking points that are going to be radically different and far more sophisticated than the libertarians that we speak
They'll
to.
They'll be
on
a
YouTube.
Bit more sophisticated, but I wouldn't assume radically different.
Well, you know me. I always
You over-prepare.
I over-prepare, and I assume, and so I figured if I could have Professor Harvey say that, but I think I have said the exact same thing about the definition of freedom. You know, I know that I feel more free if I have health insurance.
Even if you're speaking to the smartest Scientologist, who is a brilliant, whip-smart, sharp debater. You still need to jump into a basic unreality.
You're talking about John Travolta.
Well, of course, the man's a genius. No, I'm just saying, I mean, libertarians, whether they're a distinguished econ professor or a guy on YouTube, you have to buy some foundations that just don't make any sense.
Right.
Any type of that argument to work.
When you have those two sort of stark, I guess, propositions, you know, do you want to live in society A or society B? When I hear those two stark propositions, I recall that moment when Peter Schiff's brother called into the program because I was slamming on Peter Schiff and wanted to debate me. And I can't remember his first name, but he's the guy who ended
Andrew Schiff.
And he ended up complaining in the New York Times. He was only making $250 a year or something. Because his brother wasn't paying him enough.
It's getting to the point where I can only take cash a couple days a week.
Ultimately, he said, well, that's the problem with the American people. They just don't accept this. And I'm like, well, you know, that's a problem. But then they go back, but the Constitution demands it. The principle that private property is far greater than anything else demands it. If we only had that libertarian utopian utopia, then, you know, it's the government interference
you're talking with somebody and I'm not even going so far as to say opposing the Civil Rights Act or whatever, but I'm just saying if you go and you say, and someone even says it's a legitimate argument to make that Howard Johnson's having their, you know, quote, freedom violated by being forced to not discriminate against customers is just as big a potential moral challenge as the institution of Jim Crow. You're just talking, like, how can you go on that train to begin with? Like, it's just a foundationally insane proposition.
Right. And so the trick with the libertarians is to in terms of a debate, to actually get a full segment out of it is not to get to that loggerheads too quickly.
Right.
Because then it's just a question of like, well, all right, you subscribe to a notion that only benefits yourself, and the vast majority of Americans, if provided that stark choice, would absolutely say no. It's a good thing that you wrap it in the cloak of, well, actually, this is going to help them in some way. The magic box, right? The hedge funder makes $3 billion, magic box, everybody gets a TV.
or something
gets
that effect.
TV out of it. So you start there, then hopefully you get them to endorse slavery, and then you go to loggerheads, and that's a wrap.
That's right. Great. Exactly. Speaking of which, if you are a libertarian and watching on YouTube, please, by all means, call in at 646-257-3920 as we head into the funner part of the program, where we will talk about this just so fun to live in Georgia and take your kids out for a great minor league baseball game. They're going to play baseball. Maybe it'll be a little T-ball. And you're also going to give them an opportunity to learn about the Second Amendment as it is promoted in Georgia. Folks, this story is just unbelievable. And then, you know, we'll talk a little Donald Sterling, perhaps, and we'll play that Sarah Palin clip because, come on, why not? You know, it's she's part of the carnival that is the Tea Party and the Republican movement. Folks, it is your support of this program which makes it possible every day, any day, for literally pennies a day, maybe 33. You ensure that this program continues, and if enough of you pony up, grows and expands, and theoretically the quality will rise. You know, they all can't be great, but on days like when I have food poisoning, let's say, maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe the support staff would step in if there was a little bit more enticement, if we had four more members. I'm not exactly sure how that works, but Black Box,
we do step in.
Yeah, no, I know.
I don't know what you're talking about, but anyways, the point was the show
was
great today.
On Friday, I got hit with food poisoning.
Even with food poisoning, it was a great show. And where else do you get to hear a really in-depth interview with David Harvey?
I don't know.
Very few other places.
If only the support staff would step in literally days after they stepped in four times in a row.
Right, right, exactly. All right, folks, you can support this program if you really can't bring yourself to support media that you enjoy on a daily basis and buy a membership that, at the very least, I hope if you buy junk on Amazon, you buy it through our link and deny Amazon a slight cut of their profits. You could do so by going to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, always use that as your Amazon link. You will notice no difference whatsoever. We get a little kickback. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Number 646-257-3920. We'll be back in just a moment. Of course, you can always IM me as well. We'll be right back.